Thanks for joining us today on Mormon Land, where we explore news in and about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. I'm joined by managing editor Dave Noyce, who oversees the Salt Lake Tribune's faith coverage. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Peggy.
We invite you, our listeners, to show your support for Mormon Land by going to patreon.com, where, with a small donation, you can access all of the Tribune's religion coverage, transcripts to our podcasts, and an extended Mormon Land newsletter. Again, that's Patreon, patreon.com/Mormonland. Now for today's show. Marriage in a Latter-day Saint temple is called a sealing, which is believed to stretch beyond death into the eternities. So what happens when a couple splits up? Well, for devout members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that's much more complicated than a governmental divorce. In today's world, that is something called a, quote, sealing cancellation, quote. But there are different rules for men and women. Men can be sealed to more than one woman without any cancellation, but women can be sealed only to one man, so must obtain a cancellation if divorced. And rules about who can be sealed to whom in the hereafter via proxy rituals are different from living couples. Many believe this confusion reflects remnants of polygamy. But does it? Here to discuss this is Nathan Oman, a Latter-day Saint law professor at William & Mary in Virginia, who has been researching the history of the faith's modern sealing rules and has discovered some startling facts. Nate, welcome.
Thanks for having me today.
Okay, so how did marriage, divorce, and sealings work for Latter-day Saints in the 19th century?
So in the 19th century, under territorial Utah law, it was actually really vague how you got married. There wasn't any law statute that explained how you got married. So basically, if you agreed to be married, you were married. And the result of that is that all temple sealings were marriages, and there wasn't a separate law of marriage. You just got married by getting sealed, and there wasn't any distinction between a temple sealing and a marriage, a legal marriage.
Were there marriage laws in other states or territories?
Yes. The tradition under American law is that each state passes a statute, and that statute explains how it is that you get married. And one of the very odd things about Utah law is that they never passed a statute that explained how it was that legally you got married. There was no law that answered that question, no statutory law. There was, interestingly, a divorce statute. So you could get, there was a statute that explained how you got divorced. You get divorced by going to the local probate court, but you could also get divorced by petitioning the president of the church for what was called a church divorce. And you would get a certificate that would claim that you were divorced. So there was marriage and there was divorce. So in 1888, Congress passes a law that says, hey, Utah, you have to pass a marriage statute. You have to have a law that explains how you get married in Utah. So after 1888, they start developing a distinction between the religious sealing and the legal marriage, which didn't exist before. And then prior to about 1890, everybody assumed that a church divorce was a legal divorce, that it had this legal consequence of dissolving a legal marriage. And that people start doubting that about 1890. And in 1899, the Utah Supreme Court declares in a case called Norton v. Tufts that church divorces have no legal efficacy. And so even though you've got a certificate of divorce from the president of the church, you're not really divorced. So the result is that in that period, in the final decade of the 19th century, the church has to separate out the difference between its religious sealing rituals and legal marriage. Whereas prior to that period, those two things had been sort of tightly intertwined with one another.
So you're saying that when they had the two, if you got a church divorce, would that nullify the sealing too at that time period?
So many people have assumed that that was the case, but that is actually not true. So Brigham Young was actually quite explicit in on this, in which he said, look, the bill of divorce that you get from me when you try to get a divorce doesn't dissolve the sealing. It's just a divorce. And those church divorces dealt with the things that divorces always deal with, right? The distribution of property, child support, alimony, things like that. And so that church divorce was not understood to be a cancellation of sealing. And you weren't required to get a cancellation of a sealing to be remarried. So with a research assistant, I did some research and we found cases of women who had been sealed and therefore married. And then it obtained a secular divorce by just going to the local probate court. Because in 19th century Utah, you get divorced in two ways. And then had been sealed a second time. And so then we went into the church records and said, okay, did these people also get a church divorce or try to get a sealing, cancellation of sealing or anything like that? And the answer is they didn't. So if you were sealed and then you got divorced, the divorce rendered you eligible for a second sealing. You didn't have to do a further step of getting the previous sealing canceled.
So that was true for men and women?
That was true for men and women. So the rule was symmetrical in the 19th century. Now, theologically, what was going on, people in this period, right, Latter-day Saints were, especially the higher leadership of the church, were very committed to the idea of polygamy. And so how they would have understood the eternal significance of those sealings for men and women might have been somewhat different. Although even there, there's sort of wiggle room. So that they didn't necessarily think that a woman who had divorced an abusive husband and then the husband had been sealed to someone else was going to be sealed to the abusive husband in the hereafter. Brigham Young is actually pretty explicit about saying that, you know, a righteous man is not going to have multiple wives in the eternity, or an unrighteous man is not going to have multiple wives in the eternities. But the rule, in terms of just the rule, it's symmetrical for women and for men. You to do the second sealing, you don't have to get a cancellation of the previous sealing.
And I understand that Brigham Young is pretty liberal about allowing divorces.
Yes, that's true. So with, as is oftentimes with Brigham Young, you have to look at what Brigham Young says and then what Brigham Young does. So if you look at what Brigham Young says, Brigham Young is very harsh about divorce and is very down on divorce and does not like or approve of divorce. But if you look at people filing for divorces, like, he basically granted divorces very liberally, and he tended to grant divorces much more liberally to women than to men. So men who wanted to divorce, particularly plural wives, and walk away from them, Brigham tended to be pretty harsh on those women, on those men. But women, particularly in plural marriages that were unhappy and wanted to get a divorce, they were very liberal in terms of granting those divorces.
Did they all have to go through Brigham Young?
So the procedure is a little bit complicated. So you would petition Brigham Young, but oftentimes Brigham would sort of say, I don't know anything about this. And he'd refer it to the bishop, and the local bishop would look into it. And then they'd send it up to Brigham Young, and Brigham Young would say, yes, I will grant the church divorce. And then the final divorce certificate, the bill of divorce, was actually drafted as a contract between the two parties in which they contractually agreed to dissolve their divorce. It all looks very legal. There's no like theological language in it. And it's actually not even signed by Brigham Young. So the procedure is a little bit complicated. But the gist of it is that at some point, the First Presidency would have a say in every one of these church divorces.
So this is a key thing now we're going to be talking. So how and when did the concept of cancellation of sealings come about, develop?
The idea of cancellation of sealings develops at the end of the 19th century. It develops largely in response to two things that are happening. The first is that it becomes clear that church divorces don't have any legal significance. And so then there's a question of like, well, what are we doing when we grant a church divorce? And there were actually several different answers to that. Sometimes the answer is we're just kind of dealing with legacy polygamous marriages that can't use the secular legal system. But Joseph F. Smith, who's in the first presidency in the 1890s, articulates this idea that a church divorce cancels the sealing. Now, not everybody believed that. That was what Joseph F. Smith thought. It's not clear that everybody else thought that. The other thing that's happening is that in 1894, Wilford Woodruff changes the nature of temple worship when he abolishes something called the law of adoption. And under the law of adoption, you would be sealed to a high church leader rather than to your ancestors. And then in 1894, Wilford Woodruff says, no, you should be sealed to your ancestors. At which point in time, there were lots of people who were like, grandma is sealed to Brigham Young. Can she be sealed to grandpa instead? And they would write these letters to Wilford Woodruff. And Wilford Woodruff, when he would receive those requests, would say, we'll cancel the previous sealing so that now grandma can be sealed to grandpa. And so initially, the idea of cancellation of sealings is actually not really about divorce. It's kind of a cleanup mechanism for the end of the law of adoption. Even once the idea of cancellation of sealings becomes well established in the opening decades of the 20th century, it is not understood as being a prerequisite for the ability of a woman or man to be sealed a second time after a divorce. Instead, it was really kind of seen as like an exceptional remedy. So you would only cancel a marriage sealing if there was like some really good reason to do so, like there had been abuse or apostasy or something like that. But it wasn't a requirement that a sealing be canceled before a man or a woman could be sealed a second time after a divorce or after the death of the previous spouse. It was just sort of something the first presidency could do, but you didn't have to get it.
So, well, how did it become so different for men and women? How and when did that happen?
So I can answer the when question with greater certainty than I can answer the why question. The when question is that rule seems to develop at the end of the 1920s and the beginning of the 1930s. So by early 1930, by about 1930 or so, I found documents in which people are saying it is the rule in the church that in order for a woman to be sealed a second time, the previous sealing must be canceled by the first presidency. But in order for a man to be sealed a second time, the previous sealing does not need to be canceled. Now, that rule isn't actually written down in any church handbook until 1944, but it seems to have happened in the 1920s. In the 1920s, George F. Richards, who is an apostle, is sort of given the job of streamlining and formalizing temple rules. And this seems to be coming out of George F. Richards's reforms. So that's the timing of when that happens. In the 1930s is also when that becomes the rule for posthumous proxy sealings. So between 1894 and 1934, when people went to do sealings for their ancestors, if you found like your great-great-grandfather, grandmother had been married to three men, under the rules that were in place, your great-great-grandmother was supposed to get sealed to all three of the men to whom she had been married in life. It's a little complicated how that happened, but that was basically what the rules required. In 1934, they changed the rules for proxy sealings. So now if I find that my great-great-grandmother was married to three different men, she can only be sealed to one of them, and she's supposed to be sealed either to her first husband or to the husband that she would have wanted to have been sealed in eternities to, if you knew what that was, which of course is a...
So if you had some kind of written proof or something, so...
Well, in some cases, there might
have been proof. There probably was, yeah.
Because now you've got like third generation Latter-day Saints and grandma was a member, but she never made it to the temple. But she always said, my first husband was an SOB. I always wanted to be married to my second husband. But absent something like that, you're supposed to be married to the first husband. So all of that sort of shifts about 1930. Why that happens, I don't know. I can speculate. And here's my
Let's hear it.
Here's my speculation. At the time, the president of the church is Heber J. Grant. Heber J. Grant is a polygamist. He had been married polygamously before the manifesto. He had actually been subject to legal persecution in the 1880s. He was a polygamist, and he believed, I think, absolutely that polygamy was an eternal principle in the hereafter. In the opening decades of the 20th century and during his time as president of the church, Heber J. Grant is spending an enormous amount of time trying to squash polygamists within the church. He's trying to get rid of essentially the folks who became the kind of founding fathers and mothers of the fundamentalist Mormon movement. And he's trying to kick them out of the church. So I just speculate he's stuck in this position. And the other senior members of the church are in a similar situation where he believes in polygamy, but he finds himself in the role of sort of pretty harsh anti-polygamist. So I wonder if, to a certain extent, the idea was that I'm going to hang on to polygamy in the afterlife, because that's a way of sort of managing the cognitive dissonance of being a committed believing polygamist theologically, while at the same time actually pursuing a really harsh anti-polygamy campaign within the church. I have no evidence that that was the reason. Like, there's no document that I found that actually explains the reason for this at all. But that's sort of what's happening at the time. And I have to believe that that was part of what was going on in people's minds. I do know that after the church says you can no longer perform polygamous marriages in this world, there were lots of people that would say basically, well, we still want to be polygamists. And so what we're going to do is, like, we're going to agree that, like, you'll be my polygamist husband, and we'll just wait till one of us dies and perform the sealing after we're one or both of us are dead. And so there is this sense in the early 20th century that there were lots of people that were wanting to use posthumous sealings as a way of sort of continuing to practice polygamy in a theological sense. And it may be that the rules that are developed in the late 1920s, early 1930s are in part kind of a formalization of that idea.
So
what's interesting to me is they're not 19th century sealing rules. This is not Brigham Young's sealing rules continued into the 20th century. They're actually doing something quite new in 1930 by creating this very tight connection between the idea of the cancellation of the sealing and the second sealing. I actually haven't found any evidence that Brigham Young thought that he had the authority to cancel sealings. I haven't found documents in which Brigham Young says, you know, I'm canceling a sealing. And I found a sermon where he explicitly disclaims that that's what he's doing. So I just don't think that's how 19th century Mormons thought about it. I think that's a 20th century way of thinking about it.
So I have a quick question about the 1940s and this. Obviously, the 1940s is World War II. Mm-hmm. So these couples, young couples, get married. Husband goes off to war and gets killed. So no children. These widows marry a second time, but children, she can't be sealed to a second husband. I mean, she can't be sealed to that guy, the second husband. So all the children of the second guy are still sealed to the first guy.
So
how did the church, have you seen any records about that?
Yeah. So actually there's quite there. Yes, I have seen records of this. And,
okay.
And the answer is that while the church promulgated rules, mm-hmm. The first presidency has always maintained discretion over what they can do. And there were numerous cases involving the situation you're talking about, where there's a marriage in the temple, and then the husband is killed in the war, and then the young widow remarries. And so what could have happened in that case is the young woman could have petitioned the first presidency to cancel the first sealing so she could be sealed to the second. But oftentimes these young women, they did not want to cancel the first sealing. And in numerous cases, what happened is the first presidency just permitted the second sealing. So after the rule, so-called, is created in 1930, there are many times when the first presidency grants an exception to that rule. And so what you had is women who are sealed, have been sealed during their lives to multiple men, and those sealings have never been canceled. All of those cases that I've seen involve widows, not divorcees. They made exceptions. The other thing that happens, and this is kind of crucial, I think, is in 1945, George Albert Smith becomes president of the church, and he's actually the first president of the church who's not a polygamist, right? And he's president of the church. And then David O. McKay does not believe that polygamy is an eternal principle. David O. McKay made a distinction between what he called principles and what he called practices. And practices were like temporary things that might be authorized by the Lord or by revelation, but weren't eternal principles. So David O. McKay believes that polygamy is a practice, but not a principle. So he is not committed, I think, to maintaining this sort of sharp structure of eternal polygamy in the hereafter. And I think to a certain extent, he looks at kind of multiple sealings for men. And he's like, well, maybe that's polygamy in the hereafter, but maybe not. Maybe the Lord's going to do something else. And I don't quite know what is going to happen. So I think he's more comfortable than saying to women, well, we'll just do multiple sealings then. But he's not necessarily comfortable with just saying, we're going to throw out the Heber J. Grant rule. But David O. McKay does not believe in eternal polygamy. And I think Heber J. Grant did.
So what do you know about the role of ex-spouses in the modern practices of sealing cancellations?
There was a short-lived rule whereby ex-spouses had to were required to be consulted before there would be a cancellation of sealing. That rule was jettisoned, but I think in practice, local leaders and stake presidents will make inquiries with ex-spouses and have been encouraged to do so. And the reason, at least at the very high level, I mean, I don't know what's locally happening at the level of bishops and stake presidents who have quite a bit of discretion. But if you look at the rules that are promulgated by the church, I think it's very clear that the big concern that they have is you have a couple, one of the couple that are married in the temple. One member of the couple has an adulterous relationship with someone else that results in divorce. And then the adulterous couple marry and then want to get sealed in the temple. And the first presidency, if you look at the rules that are promulgated over the course of the 20th century, is clearly like really uncomfortable with this dynamic. So you generate these rules where people have to ask for permission. The other thing you have to remember is that prior to the 1970s, there was not no fault divorce didn't really exist in the United States. So in order to get divorced, you had to show some kind of fault by one of the spouses. And oftentimes that was adultery. It was not completely unreasonable to believe that in cases of divorce, the probability that there had been adultery was pretty high. It wasn't necessary to show adultery, but there was a probably pretty high probability of adultery before the rise of no-fault divorce in the 1970s. And so you get, I think, a set of norms around sort of like, let's poke into this to see what happened and if what is happening here is a second adulterous sealing, and we're concerned about that. happening.
And when the time that ex-spouses had to give their permission, that was men or women, right?
Yes, that okay. was men or women. That the formal, you've got to get, you have to get formal input. That rule did not last very long, okay. Like 5 or 6 years.
Okay.
What has sort of been put in place of that is that for a long time, if you had been divorced, if you wanted to get any kind of a temple recommend at all, you would have to petition the first presidency to get a temple recommend. And so then that would result in policing. And then the first presidency decided, we don't want to do that. That's a lot of work, presumably. And so you had to get a special clearance from the state presidency to get a temple recommend after a divorce. And then, but they maintained the idea that in order to get sealed a second time, you have to get a first presidency clearance. So even though men don't have to petition the first presidency to get their sealing canceled, throughout the 20th century and through today, men have to petition the first presidency to get sealing clearance a second time. So the first marriage, you just get a temple recommend and then you get married in the temple. But for second marriages, it actually has to go up to the first presidency to get a clearance. The difference is just that for women also have to get a cancellation of sealing, but men don't.
So, Nate, I was reading through a kind of compilation of letters to the first presidency a while ago and their responses and statements that they issued. And I was struck by how many questions are directed to the first presidency throughout the decades on these very issues. And each one so specific to different family situations and what the first presidency's answers are. And they seem to be, for all over the map. You know, as we all know how families are, you know, the dynamics vary. What's your impression of that and how difficult this can be to navigate and have a policy that covers it?
Yeah. So, Latter-day Saints like to say, like, we believe in happy families. And then through the temple, happy families can continue in eternity. The problem, of course, is that if one has a sort of tight vision of exactly what family structure in the eternities looks like, and then that is going to be validated in temples, it becomes really, really messy, really, really, really fast. One place you can see this particularly, I think, is with proxy sealing ordinances. So in 1934, for proxy marriage sealings, the church adopts the rule for dead people was the same as the rule for living people, right? Which is the woman can only be sealed to one person. In 1930, when they adopted that rule, people didn't go to the temple very much. There weren't a lot of temples, and there wasn't this strong sense that, like, Latter-day Saints were supposed to be going to the temple all the time. So that changes in the 1950s and 1960s when they start building lots of temples and saying everybody should go to the temple all the time. So if everybody goes to the temple all the time, you show up at the temple, and someone has to have a name of a deceased person for whom you can do temple ordinances. And only a minority of Latter-day Saints do genealogy for their own ancestors. And so there was this just logistical question of what happens when someone shows up at the temple and asks for a name. And in the late 1950s, they didn't have enough names. So temples actually started closing down. They weren't open all the time, because if they were open all the time, they would go through the names too quickly. And by the late 1960, the temples only had enough names to operate for a couple of weeks without running out of names. So one thing that the church needed to do in the 1960s, if people were going to have regular temple worship as part of sort of ordinary Latter-day Saint life, devotional life, is the temples just needed a lot of names. And so they started the name extraction program, where they just did a kind of massive dump of genealogical records, like parish registries and things like that, and sent those names off to the temple for ordinances to be performed. When you scale up temple ordinances at that massive level, it's not possible to perform marriage sealings based on the 1934 rule, where only the first the wife is only sealed to her first husband, because oftentimes it's impossible to determine who the first husband is, or if there's multiple husbands, without doing very, very detailed genealogical work. And even then, you can't be certain. So the church is then faced with this question. You can either have mass temple work, or you can have this tight conception of how the hereafter is going to work based on your sealing ordinances. And the church in 1968 chooses mass temple work. They say they change the rule for proxy sealings, and they just say, everybody just be sealed to everybody to whom they'd ever been married, and we're going to let the Lord sort of sort that out in the eternities in some way. And so in a way, the modern emphasis on temple worship is actually premised on a lot of theological ambiguity about precisely the meaning of those temple ordinances for the structure of eternal families, whatever it is that that means and whatever it is they're going to look like. And I don't think that there's any clearly articulated theology about precisely what those multiple sealings are going to mean, other than the Lord will sort it out. The Lord wants everybody to be happy. And it is necessary and important for Latter-day Saints to perform these ordinances, to form, Joseph Smith called it, some welding link between the generations. But beyond that high level of abstraction, if you get into the details, I don't think there's a consistent answer that has been given as to the meaning of those temple ceilings.
Wasn't it, though, fairly recently that women could be sealed posthumously to more than one? I mean, there's something that happened sort of in the last decade.
So what happens is, so it proceeds in, the rule is loosened up in stages over a long period of time. So first, they have the name extraction program, which begins in the early 1960s. And so then they say women can be sealed to multiple husbands, provided that the women we're talking about are for the name extraction program. Right. But right, that's not the true. Like if you're doing genealogy for your grandma and you're submitting the names instead of the name extraction program, then the 1934 rule applies and grandma can only be sealed to her first husband. Then in 1968, the rule for posthumous sealings in general is brought into line with what had been the rule for name extraction names, which is grandma can be sealed to all of the men to whom she was married, unless grandma was a Latter-day Saint during her lifetime. And if she was a Latter-day Saint during her lifetime, then grandma could only be sealed to either her first husband or the person that we think she would have wanted to have been sealed to. And then in the 1980s, they get rid of that rule. So the most recent shift here for posthumous sealings has been for women, for Latter-day Saint, for posthumous marital sealings for Latter-day Saint women who were baptized in their lifetimes, but were not sealed in their lifetimes. And that rule in the 1980s is brought into conformity with what had been the rule for name extraction names two decades earlier. And so it evolves slowly over time.
But now isn't it the case that women, everybody has to be dead in order for this to work, right? But
yes.
So you can't, if you're a living woman who wants to be sealed to your deceased husband's, plural, you can't do that, right?
No, you can't. You have to wait until everybody's dead.
And then you can do it.
And then you can
proxy.
Do it. Or you can petition the first presidency and ask for permission to do it. Uh-huh. And the first presidency on numerous occasions has granted such permission.
But it's still an exception to the rule, not the rule, right?
Yes, still is an exception to the rule, not the rule. So a woman can be sealed to all of the husbands to whom she was married during her life. But you have to wait until she is dead and you have to wait till all of her husbands are dead.
Right.
Right. So, like a woman who was sealed, and then her first husband dies, and then she is married to a man who that man might have been previously sealed to, say, a widow who died. He can be sealed and she can be sealed based on their second marriage, but they both have to be dead before that can happen.
So as we start to wrap up, Nate, I just got to ask, right out, do you think the church will change or should change the sealing cancellation practices to have the same requirements for living women and men?
So the rule for current living sealings, which is this odd 20th century way of kind of saying that we're practicing polygamy without practicing polygamy. And it really is. It's a 20th century thing. It's not a 19th century thing. That rule, I think, creates a lot of heartache and spiritual anxiety for people. And I think it's based on a theology that at least I know some members of the presence of the church reject. I think it probably would make good sense to get rid of that rule. So then the question is, what rule do you put in its place? And there you have two choices. You could go with the rule that says, well, as soon as you're divorced, you can just get the sealing canceled as a matter of course. And then that leaves open the question of, well, what do you do with people who are widowed? Their first spouse dies and they want to be sealed a second time. Does that sealing have to be canceled? Or not canceled. So everybody can get a cancellation of sealing based on divorce would sort of deal with the anxiety people have of like, I'm sealed to my rotten ex-spouse and I don't want to spend eternity with them. Although the church has spent the last 100 years in official discourse saying over and over and over again, even though the sealing is there, you're not going to be stuck with your spouse in the eternities, your rotten ex-spouse in the eternities. The other alternative you could do would be to just go back to the 19th century rule. And the 19th century rule, and it was the rule through not just the 19th century, but the early 20th century, including during this period in which we had the idea of cancellation of sealings in the early 20th century. And that rule is that when the first marriage is dissolved by death or divorce, the dissolution of the first marriage by death or divorce renders everybody eligible for a second sealing. And so then what you would have is something where the rules for women would look very much like the current rules for men, which is that everybody is just going to, there will just be serial sealings, including sealings to divorced spouses that are not canceled. And it just becomes very difficult to get any cancellation of sealing at all. And that also creates kind of anxieties, right? Where people are like, well, there are still these ordinances, sealing ordinances that are in place, and maybe I'm going to be stuck with my spouse in the eternities. I will say theologically, from the mid 20th century on, as I understand it, the church has articulated a theology of the validity of sealings that goes something like this. In order for a sealing to be valid and people to be connected in the eternities, three things must happen. First, the couple must desire to be sealed to one another in the eternities. Secondly, a valid ordinance performed by someone with the sealing authority must be performed either by the couple or by proxy. And third, God must bless the sealing through the Holy Spirit of promise, which is how the language that gets used. And if any one of those three conditions fails, then the sealing is not valid in the eternities. But people still have this anxiety of like the previous sealing exists. You kind of have those two choices, and both of them, I think, will leave ambiguity. And that ambiguity will generate anxiety. But I think that that's probably a better kind of ambiguity and anxiety than the sort of stark asymmetry you get with living ceiling rules and the association that has with polygamy. And given that the church doesn't, in fact, endorse the theology on which that is based anymore explicitly, the church sort of says, we don't know. It seems odd that that is still remains kind of hardwired into those ceiling rules.
Nathan Oman, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to Dave Noyce.
Always a pleasure.
And to our producer, Chris Samuels. We remind our listeners that they can keep up on all the happenings in and about the church by subscribing to the Salt Lake Tribune's free Mormon Land newsletter. Just go to sltrib.com to sign up, and we'll talk again next time on Mormon Land.